We do have some schedules here of events at the University of Michigan campus. For those of you who are interested, there is a white mimeograph schedule which lists the Astronomical Film Festival for this term, which in fact is now over. The last program was 2 weeks ago. There will be, however, another series starting in May, and it tells on this sheet how to send away stamp self-addressed envelope to be guaranteed that you will be on the mailing list for the next schedule as soon as it comes out. And I'd recommend, if you are interested in that at all, those of you who are interested enough to go down to Ann Arbor for these, that you simply send in one of the envelopes right away. There is also a listing of all the other things that happen on the U of M campus, and there's also a listing of lecture series which I give elsewhere in the state, all of which are now over with the exception of the one here at Michigan State, and unfortunately that is the one thing on this white mimeograph sheet which is now wrong. So if you get a copy of the sheet, believe everything that it says except the ones about your own hometown. The reason that it's wrong is not that there was anything wrong when it was printed, but that we had some snowstorms, as you may possibly recall, and as a result of those, we had to postpone two of the programs in this series that Bob suggested. And as you also noticed, neither Bob, who is with Abrams Planetarium, which is sponsoring the series, nor myself, who am giving it, can remember anymore when the dates are. So it's gotten so convoluted. But the correct schedule update is on the half sheets, which are in the back of the room, as Bob mentioned. And so get a copy of those for sure, and then you'll know when the next programs are, and get a copy of the white sheet, and you'll know everything else, but ignore what it says about the Michigan State. Thank you much. April 13th and 27th, that's the voice of Bob Victor again. And May 11th would be the last one. And then, yeah, April 13th is Black Holes. I hope that nobody is here today for Black Holes. I hope that the message that got postponed has been satisfactorily spread around. As a result of these postponements, we had to push them all back once. So if you are here for Black Holes, we have made this room into a model black hole. You can get in, but you cannot leave. There are armed guards at the doors. So this will help you understand the subject, you see, and you might as well forget it. You might as well sit here and listen to Beyond Jupiter. Beyond Jupiter is the title of tonight's lecture. This is the second of a series of two, but if you missed the first one last month, don't worry about it. It should be independently understandable. The reason there are a series of two is to prepare you for the Voyager spacecraft missions, which begin in terms of, well, they've already been launched, but they begin in terms of arrival at the first planet, which is Jupiter itself, next year. And then Voyager 1 will go on to Saturn from Jupiter. It will arrive at Saturn in late 1980, and Voyager 2 will follow it in mid-1981. Last time I talked about Jupiter and about what we hope, a little bit about what we hope the Voyagers will do at Jupiter. I'll say more about that this time. And in addition, I told you what is known about the outer planet in general, and that's the part that I am going to have to repeat for those of you who were not here last time. Saturn is an outer planet, just like Jupiter. In the outer solar system, you find a completely different kind, in fact, several completely different kinds of bodies, both moons and planets, than what we tend in our inner solar system chauvinism to think of as being normal. We think that a planet ought to be made of rock and metal because the ones that we know best, the ones here huddled around the fire in the inner solar system, are. In fact, that is the exception. The majority of the worlds in the solar system, both moons and planets, are in the outer solar system, that is beyond the orbit of Mars. There are at least 35 separate worlds out there, not counting the asteroids in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And I will tell you about most of those tonight. I told you about Jupiter and its 13 or 14, I'm not sure which moons last time, and all the rest of them tonight, including Chiron, which was the object discovered last year that at the time was incorrectly described by most news media other than NPR as a 10th planet. It is not a 10th planet. In many ways, it's more interesting than that. So you've got all these things out there, and the majority of them are not made of rock. And you see, since that's the majority, well, by definition, your average body is not made of rock. The big planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, are made primarily of hydrogen and helium. And this means that although they're enormous, to give you the scale of this picture that you're seeing here, our Earth could easily fit in between Saturn and the rings and have a little bit of space left over. The size of the Earth would be about the size of this circle that I'm making with the tip of my arrow. They are not only, they're enormous, but they don't weigh as much as you might expect. Yeah, they do not weigh as much as they would if they were made of the same things as the Earth, but the same size as they actually are. Saturn, in fact, is so lightweight, so low in density, that it actually weighs less than an equal volume of water would. In other words, if you could find a bathtub big enough, Saturn would float in it like a cork. And if you imagine dropping the Earth into a giant bathtub and expecting it to float like a cork, you know, immediately your intuition will tell you that it will sink like a stone, which is exactly what it is. And that will immediately give you a powerful intuitive impression of the difference between the Jovian planets, which are these light gas giants in the outer solar system, and the terrestrial planets, which include the rocky type that you get in the inner solar system. Of course, there's another difference, too, which is that when you let the water out of the bathtub, in Saturn's case, it would leave a ring. Well, the... Thank you. The moons in the outer solar system are also, for the most part, different from those in here. In many cases, we simply don't know enough about them to be able to tell you what they're made of. But in a number of cases, such as those that I mentioned last time, and especially one Titan that I'll mention tonight, we know that they are made primarily not of rock, not of metal, but of frozen water, frozen methane, frozen ammonia, or combinations thereof. And last time we talked in some detail about why there are all these differences, why bodies in the outer solar system are made of such different materials. I'm not going to go into that again because it's an interesting story, but a very long one. However, suffice it for the present to say that it is. So, with that much background, for those of you who weren't here last time, let's get on the material that will be due to everybody, and that is, let's talk about Saturn itself. First thing that you notice is, well, of course, the first thing you notice is the ring. I'll ask you to ignore the rings for a moment and concentrate on the planet inside, which I realize is a little hard to do because the rings are pretty overpowering. But the planet, you can see, is very flattened at the poles. It is not as thick through the poles as it is through the equator. And that's one of the clues to the fact that it is mostly gases and liquids, just the way Jupiter. In fact, almost certainly entirely gases and liquids, just the way Jupiter is. It rotates very rapidly, not quite as fast as Jupiter, a little over 10 hours, Jupiter's a little under 10 hours. As a result of its huge size and that rapid rotation, the complex of phenomena, which is invariably misreferred to as centrifugal force, although it is neither centrifugal nor a force, flattens the poles or throws it out of the equator. And Saturn is also made mostly of hydrogen, apparently, and after that, primarily helium. We don't know nearly as much about Saturn as we do about Jupiter because we have not had a spacecraft to it yet. As I mentioned at the very end of last time's lecture, Pioneer 11, the first spacecraft to Saturn, which will precede the Voyagers, just as Pioneer 11 and also before that Pioneer 10 preceded them to Jupiter. Pioneer 10 did not go on to Saturn, but Pioneer 11 will, and it will arrive there on September 5th of next year. So next year is going to be a pretty incredible year, well, for a whole lot of reasons. In fact, it went through the whole list last time. But just for the outer solar system, you're going to have the Voyager flybys of Jupiter, and although we know some things about Jupiter, we'll learn a great deal more from the Voyagers, and in particular, we will learn enormous amounts about their moons, which are about Jupiter's moons, five of them anyway, which are essentially totally unknown at present. But then in the same year, just a little bit later in the year, that the Voyagers are getting to Jupiter, Pioneer 11 will arrive at Saturn. And so we should know a good deal more about details such as what Saturn is made of, how hot it is on the inside, how dense it is, that kind of thing. And we should find out some things about the rings as well. The rings are, of course, the most obvious feature of Saturn. You can see the two major rings here, the A ring and the B ring, and there is also a C ring, which is very much fainter, and which you can't see in this particular picture. If we gave you a longer exposure, we'd overexpose A and B, we'd overexpose the planet, and then you'd be able to see C. But you can see it in this picture where it's silhouetted against the disk of the planet, and that's sometimes called the Quake ring. You can also see that there is a division between ring A and ring B, a gap where there seems to be nothing. That's called Cassini's division after the man who discovered it around 1650-something. And you get an impression by looking at this picture, which is in fact false, and that is that the rings are some sort of solid plates, and that you can land a spacecraft on them and get out and run around on them and have fun. And in fact, that is not what they are, and the reason that you have that impression is that this is really a very lousy picture. I realize it doesn't look like it. It looks like a pretty good picture. But in fact, you cannot see anything on this picture smaller than about 1,000 miles across. Because after all, Jupiter is 1 billion miles away from the Earth. But the reason the picture looks so good is that on Saturn, since the thing is so huge, 1,000 miles is quite a small amount. And so you don't realize at this scale that is small enough that, say, we show the entire planet, the deal sky on either side, that in fact you're not able to see very much detail. There are a number of ways of proving that the rings are not solid plates. The easiest is simply to take advantage of the fact that every once in a while Saturn passes directly between the Earth and the star, and so the star disappears behind the rings, except that it doesn't. The point is that it does not disappear, it gets dimmed, but you can see the star right through the rings. And you can also prove theoretically that bodies that large that were solid sheets could not possibly exist. They would break up. And so even if somehow you could start them out of solid sheets, which is ridiculous, because there's no way you could form them. There's no natural mechanism to form such things. They would break up instantaneously. And there are other ways as well. You measure the rotation using something called Doppler shift that I'm sure many of you know about. Measure the speed of the inner part of the ring, and it's not the same as that of the outer part of the ring, so they're not rotating solid bodies and so forth and so on. Okay, what the rings are is millions and millions of very small particles. We do not know how big they are, we don't know how many they are, we're hoping with Pioneer 11 or failing at the Voyagers will find out some of these things for us, but they are no more than a few miles in size, each of the individual particles, and they may be very much smaller than that. They may be only inches in size, or you name it. Of course, there's probably a whole spectrum of sizes, and so what I'm really talking about is an average. We do know what they're made of. There are two different methods by which you can find out from Earth what these solid bodies are made of. One is by looking at their spectra, and some of you know what that means, and those of you that don't, it's a long, complicated story. Don't worry about it. It's a way we have to find out what things are made of, that we can see light from, even though we can't get at them. And it turns out that that particular method is very sensitive to ice, and is not sensitive to rock. And the reason for that is simply that it's a means of analyzing the light that we see from the rings, and if there's a mixture, say, of ice and rock, what you're going to have is the ice is going to dominate, right? Because the ice is bright, the dark, and the rock is dark. You know, if you're going to see the ice, you look at it spectroscopically. Well, when we look at it spectroscopically, we do indeed see ice, and I mean literally ice, but old frozen water. It's frozen water at a very low temperature, about 250 below zero Fahrenheit, and we can measure that from the spectrum too, because the spectrum turns out to be kind of weird when you get down to that low temperature, so much so there was an embarrassing episode about 10 years ago in which for about 2 or 3 months, we thought we had found out what the rings were made of, it turned out to be something totally different, and we were just misidentifying this unusual spectrum of water. So, you look at the rings and you see ice. There's another means that you can use, and that is you can bounce radar off the rings from 1 billion miles away here on the Earth, which is a pretty incredible fact. We're able to do this, but it has been done. You do not get any radar return from Saturn itself. The radar waves simply sink into the interior and get absorbed, and they never get reflected. And the reason is that there is no solid surface in Saturn for them to reflect off. They have exactly the same thing to try to bounce radar off Jupiter. But the radar will reflect off Jupiter's moons very well. That's one of the ways we know they're solid. And it will also reflect off the rocks very well. Ice happens to be almost transparent to radar, but rock will reflect it quite well. And so the fact that you get a radar return implies that there's rock in there. Now, I have seen any number of popular articles and newspaper stories and so forth which have explained that there is a big controversy among planetary scientists as to whether Saturn's rings are made of ice or rock. And the reason for this is the spectroscopists say that they're made of ice and the radar people say they're made of rock. I would like to make the modest proposal that since you've got one technique that can detect light, ice but not rock, and another one that can detect rock but not ice, and you get a detection both times, I would like to suggest they are made of a mixture of ice and rock. Or, in fact, thank you. You heard it here first. And, no, in fact, if you talk to any planetary scientist as opposed to the way these people write the articles, they say the same thing. They're made of a mixture of ice and rock, or else they are made of particles of rock that are coated with ice. And, of course, the obvious question is where they come from and how they get there. And then there are secondary questions like why we see continuous division and so forth. You realize by this time, I think, that when one place in the rings, like there, looks brighter than another place, say over there, or especially, say, the crater, which is quite dark, it is not necessarily because they're made of different materials. It is probably just that there is a greater number of particles per cubic mile of space there than there is there, and a greater number there than there is there, and so on. And when you look at what seems to be the empty space outside them, or in Cassini's division, or in the space between the great rings and the planet, it is not necessarily true that that space really is empty. There may be particles there, there just aren't enough for you to see. We do not know whether there are particles in the space in between the rings and the planet. And there's only one way to find out, and that is to send a spacecraft through there and see if it survives. The obvious candidate for that would have been Pioneer 11. Because Pioneer 11, by the time it gets to Saturn, will be so near the end of any useful light that it might have, simply because its radioactive power sources are dying. The radioisotopes that fuel it are running through the end of their useful lifetimes, if they were intended to, that there'd be no point in trying to save the spacecraft. And this is something that's never come up before in planetary missions. Always there has been some reason to save the spacecraft after the end of its nominal mission to use it for something else. And in this particular case, it would not be. You couldn't send it on to Uranus, for example, it would be dead before it got there. The spacecraft physically would arrive, of course, but it would not have any power, so it would not send back any data. The Voyagers, on the other hand, will last long, long after there to fly past Saturn. In fact, there is every reason that we could continue to at least hear from them for as much as 100 years after the launch, by which time they would be something like 10 times as far out of space as the orbit of Pluto. So you want to save the Voyagers. They're our first probes of interstellar space. And the obvious candidate for a kamikaze mission, if that's what it turned out to be, to go through that space in between the rings and the planet, was Pioneer 11. And this was indeed what almost everybody expected was going to be done with it. A month ago, NASA made what, in my opinion, is a very cowardly decision, and one that disappointed me extremely, and that is they decided to chicken out on that and not go through that space between the rings and the planet and have Pioneer 11 fly out there, beyond the rings. Now, the reason for this, supposedly, was that it was safer. In fact, most of the Pioneer scientists wanted to take a chance and try it. In fact, some of them said, this is going to get much closer than the Voyagers will. The Voyagers are going to go way out beyond the rings just because we do want to preserve them afterwards. And the rings may be beautiful, but they may be very dangerous also. So you don't want to do anything like hazarding the Voyagers by sending them in there. The Voyagers have such powerful cameras that even from a much greater distance, they will get much more detailed pictures of Saturn than Pioneer 11 would, but even if it went inside the ring. But they will not physically go in there. So this would be our only chance to find out the nature of things like Saturn's magnetic field and so forth close in. And a number of the Pioneer scientists said, even if the spacecraft were destroyed, in the first place, that would teach us something important. That is, we would know that danger is in there, that there are significant numbers of particles in that space. And even if it were destroyed, it would be more valuable to have half a pass by Saturn and get those data from close in than to have an entire pass, both sides, but not be able to get the close in data. However, those are the Pioneer people, and they're just interested in their own projects. NASA headquarters has to be interested in all the projects, and what they decided to do was have Pioneer 11 serve as a test vehicle to make sure that the path the Voyagers are going to take is in fact safe. And so what they're going to do is not only throw away the opportunity to go inside the rings, but take exactly the same path that Voyager 2, which would be the closer of the two according to present plans, is going to take if it does certain things, well specifically if it goes on to Europe. And so what that means is we not only throw away the chance for all those data in a different region of space near Saturn, we throw away our chance for anything that doesn't duplicate what Voyager 2 will get. We simply get a duplication of the Voyager 2 mission. That still is a complete waste, because after all, there are variations in the same place from time to time. And the very fact that you are making the path the same means that any differences you see between the Pioneer 11 data and the Voyager 2 data will be due to such variations. But I'm still very disappointed. Besides, suppose the Pioneer 11 is destroyed as it goes outside the rings, which is possible too. There could very well be particles outside them as well. All right, fine. What do you then do with the Voyagers? They've got to go to Saturn. They have no choice. They're on the way, you know. And so what are you going to say? Tell them to turn around and come back home? I mean, nobody laughed. that is physically impossible. There is a control to the gravitational field of the sun and the planets as they go past. There's no way they could significantly change that flyby. So I really think sometimes I'm accused of thinking everything NASA does is great and so forth. Well, in general, I do. In general, I think they do a remarkably good job, especially considering the fact they're a government agency. But, I mean, you know, here you have the incredible case of a government agency which does a better job than it usually claims it does. They're lousy at public relations, and that's a big problem. But in this particular case, I am very much annoyed with NASA, and I wish they hadn't done it, and so I want to tell you so. Well, anyway, where do rings come from? Well, the short answer to that is we don't know any more than we know where Saturn itself came from or the rest of the solar system. But there are at least two possibilities, both of which are due to the fact that if you had a large body out there, say a big moon, at this distance from Saturn, that close in, it would be torn apart. It could not survive that close to Saturn. And the reason for that is that the tides, which Saturn's gravity would attempt to raise in whatever material was made of, even if it was a hard solid, would be so great that they would literally tear it apart. The tidal force between one side of a moon at that distance and the other side of the same moon would be greater than the gravitational force which is holding the moon itself together. The distance at which the tides become great enough to do that from a given planet is called the Roche limit, after a 17th century mathematician who first worked all this out. And the Roche limit for Saturn is right out about there, and so the rings are entirely within the Roche limit of Saturn. So one obvious possibility, which I think is probably the most likely, is that once upon a time, Saturn had an additional moon, one more than it has now. It has at least 9 that we know of. There may be 10, there may even be 11. The 10th and 11th are still controversial. But this moon, slowly, over billions of years, moved in closer and closer and closer to its planet. And this is possible. The orbit of a moon is not necessarily a sacrosanct thing that remains that way for all time. Our own moon, for example, is very slowly moving away from the Earth, moving the other direction, at the rate of about 1 inch per century. That's not very much, but if you add it up over several billion years, which is the history of the solar system, it is in fact a significant amount. In fact, it's such a significant amount that we've got some problems with that. If the moon had been retreating from the Earth at the same rate as it is now, all through the 4.5 billion year history of the solar system, then for about half of that history, it has to have been sitting inside the Earth. And it wasn't. we really don't know what to make of that. There was an old idea that the moon came out of the Pacific Ocean and that it literally was thrown out of the Earth. We now know the Pacific Ocean is only a few hundred million years old, and before that there may well have been other oceans in the same place. But the current Pacific is only, at most 250 million years old, whereas the youngest rocks that we've ever found on the moon are 3.3 billion years old. So whatever the origin of the moon, if it did come out of the Earth, which is still a possible hypothesis, it did so at the very, very beginning of the solar system's history, because an episode that violent, a planet literally splitting into two pieces, would melt the entire surface of both of the pieces. And so you simply reset all the clocks and start the history of both planets over from that point. Well, in any case, the moon is moving away from the Earth, and we know of other moons that are moving away from their planet, and we know of moons that are moving slowly in towards their planets. For example, Triton, the big moon of Neptune, and Phobos, the inner moon of Mars. And what was suggested is that there was an extra moon of Saturn, and very, very slowly, over billions of years, it moved in towards Saturn until finally it reached the Roche limit, and at that point it broke up. And the pieces are then still orbiting around at about the distance the moon was when it broke up. They are directly over Saturn's equator, you will notice. Most of Saturn's moons also have orbits that are directly over the planet's equator, and in fact that is normal for moons in the solar system in general. The 5 innermost moons of Jupiter, that's true of as well. Why did it move slowly inward? Well, in the case of the Earth's moon, what's moving it outward turns out to be a side effect of the tides that it itself causes in the oceans of the Earth. But that's a complicated story. If you want to ask me about it in the question session, I'll do it. It's too long to go into now. But generally, the answer is that the gravitational fields of either other moons going around the same planet, or the Sun, or other planets, or all of the above, together with the irregularities in Saturn's own gravitational field, are what would cause the motion. And indeed, as I say, there are other moons that are moving outward or inward towards their planets for this reason. And we can calculate the effect of the gravitational field, and also measure the rate at which the moons are moving out, and it all checks out to the last decimal place, and so, you know, there's only gravity once again. Okay, the point is that those same forces are still acting on the ring, on the particles that make up the rings of Saturn. These particles are now small enough that Saturn's gravity will not tear them apart. Below a certain size, the tidal force is not the most important thing. The actual strength of the material comes into play that the moon is made of. That's why you can set a satellite in orbit above the Earth, an artificial Earth satellite, far inside the rotational limit of the Earth, which is about 10,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, and it does not get torn apart. But a big natural moon, for example, our moon, were ever to turn around and come back in and get 10,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, which it's not going to do, but I just say this for hypothesis, it would be torn apart, and we would have a set of rings like Saturn. It is possible that one day Phobos will have Mars gravity do this to it, and Mars will have a weak set of rings. I say weak because Phobos is a very small body, and you break it into pieces, and there isn't going to be very much left. And Triton is a very large moon, it is bigger than our own moon, and so when it gets close enough into the rotational limit of Neptune, we should have some very spectacular rings about Neptune. That should happen in about 2 billion years. Well, so don't wait up for it. But it will happen. And by then, in fact, Saturn will not have its rings anymore, we don't think. The same forces, you don't have to worry about the tidal forces, but those same gravitational perturbations that made our hypothetical moon move inward until it got inside the rotational limit are still acting on the particles, and one by one those particles are moving slowly in towards Saturn, and now you know what the cratering is, and now you know why we think there may be some particles in what looks like an empty space in there between the rings and the planet. And of course, as they hit the upper atmosphere of the planet, they burn up. So one by one, those particles are being destroyed. How long are the rings going to last? We don't know, and the reason that we don't is not that we don't know the gravity involved, not that we don't know the equations involved, but there's too much other things that we don't know. We don't know what numbers to plug into the equations. We don't know how heavy most of Saturn's other moons are, and therefore what their gravitational fields are. We also do not know the size of the ring particles and how many of them there are and all that kind of thing. So you can only do crude estimates. But the estimates that have been done cluster around some time of the order of a few hundred million years. And while that may sound like a long time, it is short compared to the age of the solar system. It's nothing like 4.5 billion years, which is the age of the solar system. And so that's why I think that the other theory of the origin of Saturn's rings, that is, that this is material which would have coalesced into a moon back when Saturn was forming out of a rotating cloud of gas and dust, and there were local concentrations outside Saturn that at the same time were forming moons. This is material that would have formed into a moon, except that it was inside Saturn's rotational limit, and so it couldn't, because every time enough particles got together to form something fairly large, Saturn's tidal force just tore it apart again. That theory is popular among a lot of astronomers who don't know much about the planets. And in fact, there was a very fine article in Astronomy Magazine by a good friend of mine, Leanne Wilson, at Iowa State University, on the origin of planetary rings, making just that assumption. This was in Astronomy Magazine two months ago. While I admire Leanne for many things, I think she's wrong in this case, and I think that other people who suggest that Saturn's rings are remnants of the very origin of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago are probably going to turn out to be mistaken. It's possible that I'm wrong in that. There is a possibility that if you make a lot of rather unlikely assumptions about the size of the ring particles and how heavy Saturn's other moons are and so forth and so on, that you can stretch out their lifetimes by a factor of more than 10 from the most likely calculations and really get 4.6 billion years. But it seems unlikely. It seems like special pleading. In any case, if these calculations are correct, the rings are not going to last more than another few hundred million years. And so by the time Neptune does become a ring planet, Saturn will not be anymore. And so if you want to see rings, you're going to have to go all the way out to Neptune, and that will be a bit farther out. Finally, how about Cassini's division? Cassini's division is the distance from Saturn at which a very special thing happens. And that is, if there were a particle which were revolving around Saturn at that particular distance, you got to realize, the closer to Saturn, the shorter the period of the rings, all right? In fact, in the very inner edge of the rings, the particles are going around in less than one Saturn day. And there's only one moon in the solar system that goes around this planet in less than one of its planets a day, and that is Phobos, the inner moon of Mars. A lot of Earth satellites do it, of course. And there are these other particles, for natural examples of things that do that. And then as you go farther and farther out, they take longer and longer to go around, both because they have a longer track to go around and because they go around more slowly the farther out from the planet you get. Because the planet's gravity, which is what keeps them in orbit in the first place, is getting weaker and weaker. Well, if you had a particle that was orbiting at exactly this magic distance from Saturn, its period, the length of time that it takes to go around, would be exactly half of the period of Mimas, which is the innermost of the nine moons of Saturn whose existence we're certain. The other two, number 10, Janus, and number 11, for which a name hasn't yet been proposed, which may or may not exist, are supposed to be just outside the ring, very, very tiny, so tiny, in fact, that we're not sure that what we're seeing is not just concentrations of ring particles, slight brightness. You don't see anything obvious like that here, but if you get the rings around, so you're seeing them more of an angle, you can see that there are variations in their thickness as well. And so if you had a particle that was revolving there, it would have exactly half the period of Mimas, which means, suppose that Mimas was here, and our particle was there. Well, Mimas' gravity is obviously pulling the particle directly outward away from Saturn. If the period was not exactly a simple fraction of that of Mimas, then the next time that Mimas' gravity and Mimas' gravity was pulling it away from Saturn, it would probably be in some other direction. The particle would go around, and Mimas would go around. And over a long period of time, the various poles that Mimas exerts on the particle, trying to pull it away from Saturn, or trying to pull it, Mimas is over there, the particle's in there, in towards Saturn, so on and so forth. Those poles would average out, and there would be very little residual effect on the particle, and that's why it takes billions of years for significant changes to happen in the orbit of a moon. But if the period is exactly half that of Mimas, then, okay, there's the particle, and here's Mimas pulling it. Particle goes around exactly twice, while Mimas goes around exactly once, and when they get back to the same position, they are the gravity is pulling in exactly the same direction. So a particle at that distance just cannot stay at that distance for very long. It can pass through briefly on the way to Saturn. It takes a while for Mimas' gravity, which is fairly weak at that distance for Mimas, and Mimas is very small anyway, to add up to be very much. But for a long period of time, you cannot remain there. So Cassini's division is simply due to perturbations, that means effects by the gravity of some third object, on the orbits of particles which otherwise would be there. I want you to remember all of these things. They're relevant not only for Saturn's rings, but also for the case of the rings of Uranus, which were discovered in 1976. I'm sorry, which were discovered last year. In fact, 1 year ago tomorrow. They were discovered on March 10th, 1977. And of course, I will tell you about those later on. And so all this theory that I'm giving about Saturn's rings can then be applied immediately to the rings of Uranus, and we won't have to repeat it again. This is a picture, a set of pictures, the middle of which is taken at a time when we were exactly in the point of the rings. We were looking exactly edge onto them, and the point is they disappear. They are very, very thin. They are among the thinnest objects that are, they are in fact the thinnest objects that are known in nature. If you made a scale model of them out of tissue paper, the model would have to be at least a diameter big enough to fill this room, and it might have to be several miles across. They are so thin that we cannot measure how thin they are. There are some estimates that have been published that are in disfavor at the moment, but who knows, they might come back. We don't really know what the thickness is. There are some estimates that they may be as little as a few inches thick. More likely, they are several miles thick. But considering that their diameter is in excess of 90,000 miles, something that is just a few miles thick and 90,000 miles across is still pretty enormous. So what is it that keeps them that thin? Well, since I have sitting in front of me here a perfectly good chart recorder. Oh, wait a minute. No, I can't do it. Apparently it's all used up. Never mind. I just realized that I have my grease pencil with me anyway. I will gesticulate instead. Suppose that you have a particle which is trying to move downward into the rings, okay? In other words, you have a whole cloud of particles and some of their orbits are inclined to Saturn's equator in various directions like this. And they're all trying to coexist at about the same distance. Well, they're going to be inclined with one another. Now, all of them are moving in the same direction around Saturn. That is to say, counterclockwise rather, as seen from above the planet's north pole. And so their collisions in the horizontal direction are not going to be terribly violent, and they are not going to tend to do very much to each other's velocity. But in the vertical direction, on the average, there are going to be just as many of them coming down at a given moment as there are going up at a given moment. And every time they collide, two things are going to happen. One, of course, they're going to break into even smaller particles. But number two, the vertical portion of their seed is going to get killed. The horizontal portion is not getting killed because you don't have some particles going in one direction horizontally and other particles going in the other direction, canceling one another out. But in the vertical direction, they cancel one another out. And so even if you had originally a whole cloud of them making a big donut around Saturn, very rapidly that donut would collapse into a ring just the way you see it here. And so the reason that Saturn's rings are so thin is simply that there is no other way that they could exist and still all be in orbit around the same planet at the same distance. Here are two pictures covering the question of whether there are indeed particles in those lower right-hand spaces side and outside of the ring of the sea with the trajectory of Pioneer 11. That's not its orbit, that's an impossible orbit. That's the way that its orbit would look as seen from the Earth. What happens is it comes in on one side like this, makes a close approach to Saturn, turns around and goes out on the other side, and they've simply shown the distances above the rings and the distance from Saturn here. This is the inside option, the one that they did not take. This is the outside option, the one that they did take. And what this shows, this particular slide was put together by Jonathan Eberhardt, who does such a fantastic job of reporting space in Science News magazine, which I highly recommend, by the way, to those of you who are frustrated in not being able to find out what's going on in the space program because the blankety-blank news media don't cover it enough. Science News does cover it enough, and it's inexpensive. It's only $12.50 a year, and it covers the whole rest of science, too, as well as astronomy and space. Very, very accurate, very well written, extremely readable, believe it or not. And, well, check it out in the library and you can see for yourself. You're not going to be interested in every single issue unless you are a real Renaissance person, you know, because it does cover all of science. But see whether there aren't enough articles in the average issue to be worth just $12.50 a year for you, and I suspect you'll find that you consider it worth your while. It's pretty thin, too. It only takes about an hour a week to read, so it won't cut into your time very much. Well, in any case, this is from Science News, and John Eberhardt got all this together and showed a photograph taken by an astronomer named Garin in 1969, which hints at a possible inner ring. It looks as though it's not in the negative, as you can see, and so black sky would appear white. It looks as though it's not totally white inside even the crater ring. The crater ring would be in here. It isn't exposed so much that even the crater ring turns out overexposed if you're white. And then here we have a densitometer trace made by a device which looks with a beam of light through the picture and sees how white or dark it is. Densitometer trace of another photograph, and the densitometer trace makes it look as though there may very well be some ring particles on the outside, right where Pioneer 11 is going to be going. So it really is an open question at this point, how many particles you've got where, which really would have been safer. Okay, so much for science for a while. I don't want to forget art. We try to give you some of that with the Voyager recording. By the way, for any of you who are not aware, we are playing the recording that is on the Voyager spacecraft in four parts before each of our lectures for four of them. One you just heard, and the first part was last week, and there are two more, last month rather, and there are two more coming on whatever those dates were that Bob Victor mentioned. And those will begin at 7:05 on each of the respective dates. The remaining two portions are entirely music. And altogether, I think the Voyager recording is a really superb introduction to the music of planet Earth, whatever else you might think about it. I'm sorry, one more thing of science. I forgot that I put this slide in. It's very, very, I just got it. It hasn't been the lecture, last time I gave it. These are pictures that are a little bit hard to interpret. Saturn, in this picture, say, would be out there somewhere, and it's so enormously overexposed, you've got this huge cloud of light around the planet, which in this scale would be about like this. And then there you see one of Saturn's moons that has been called Dione, and here you see a moon named Iapetus. Iapetus is interesting for a bunch of reasons, which I'll get to when I talk about Saturn's moons, but here we are simply using it as a probe. On October 19th of last year, an exceedingly rare astronomical event happened. This had, in fact, been seen only once before in all of history, in 1885, and it has happened since earlier this year as well. And that is that Iapetus was eclipsed by the rings of Saturn. That is to say, Iapetus passed through the shadow of the rings of Saturn. Now what you do is you take advantage of the fact that the sunlight is shining through those rings. Remember, they're not solid points, so they're only semi-opaque. And the more sunlight shines through, then the thinner the average density of materials in the rings is. So simply measure the brightness of the apatite as it goes through the shadow, and you have a notion, you're using it as a probe in the sunlight off it, you have a notion of how much material there is at various distances out from the rings. Well, here you see, while it's so far out of the shadow of ring 8, it's essentially an eclipse. So this is essentially your time zero picture. And then there you see it while it's in the rings of Saturn. While it's well within the shadow of ring A, the outermost ring. And you can see it's very dim, although it is not 100% gone. The most interesting thing, perhaps, was that as it passed through the shadow of ring A, it got dark, and then it got brighter again. Not anything like all the way back up, but brighter again, and then it got dark again. Well, for more than a century, there have been reports that in addition to continuous division between the two main rings, there is a partial division, in other words, a thinning within ring A, a partial dark band, and not completely dark, but a visible dark circle. And the thing is so difficult to see that we've never been really sure that it was there. It's been given the name Encke's division after yet another astronomer. Some of you may have heard of Comet Encke, which is a well-known comet. And, well, this is really the first direct observational proof, other than somebody making a drawing of something that was so hard to see that they weren't really sure that it was there, that Encke's division actually does exist. Okay, let me now go on to the first of these. No, I'm sorry. All right, we'll get to them eventually. Apparently, I changed the order of the slides and didn't even know it. In any case, this is a picture of Saturn at a time when the rings were edge on, and so they disappeared. You can see a very faint bulge up in there, and what all these things are moons. Saturn has, as I mentioned, at least 9 moons. The supposed 10th and 11th were discovered at the same time this picture was taken, actually, back the last time that the rings were edge on, and you see this very, very faint little dot. And he thought that he saw yet another of these little dots, and, you know, maybe some, maybe not. But the ones that for sure exist are shown here. In order outward from the planet, they are minus the innermost of the ones we're sure of, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, Rhea, Titan, and then the outermost three, Hyperion, Iapetus, and Phoebe, are not shown in this particular picture. So you see, Saturn, like Jupiter, is really a miniature solar system of its own. You've got a large central body, and you've got a whole bunch of smaller objects that are revolving around it. We know almost zero about these moons. As you see, they're simply dots of light in our best telescope. The size of this dot is not the true size of the moon. That is simply the overexposed image, and the brighter the moon is, the bigger the dot appears. So you can use that to measure the brightness of the thing, and that's all. From its brightness, you can estimate its size, but you can't estimate it very well. Just think about it for a minute. Suppose you had two moons that were both the same brightness, but one of them was made of really black rock, and the other was made of something really white, say ice, or at least was covered with ice. Well, if they were the same brightness, the black one would be much bigger than the white one to appear the same brightness as seen from Earth, right? So in order to tell the size of a moon from the brightness, or the size of anything else for that matter, that simply reflects the light of the sun, for example, an asteroid, from its brightness, you have got to know how much light it reflects. You've got to know its albedo. The albedo is the percentage of light that hits an object that it reflects back into space. A white piece of paper reflects most of the light that hits it. It has an albedo of, say, 90%. A black piece of paper reflects almost none of the light that hits it. It may have an albedo of 5%. And so on and so forth. The moon, believe it or not, is made of a rather black rock. It has an average albedo of 7%. Venus, which is totally covered by clouds, has an albedo of 80%. Io, the innermost of the four big moons of Jupiter, the second moon of Jupiter, if you count all of them, has the highest albedo known in the solar system, and as I remember, something like 85 or 90%. So it's a very, very bright object. I would say it's a very white object because its color has to be red. It reflects most of the light that hits it. All right, we don't know the albedo of most of the moons of Saturn. How could we? How would we measure them? We don't know what they're made of. And so if we don't know what they're made of, they could be any albedo they like. So you say, well, for heaven's sake, guess. You know, take an albedo. Say they're the same albedo as the Earth's moon. Well, that's exactly what we do. And if you look up the size of the moons of Saturn in an astronomy textbook, that's how they got those particular numbers. But in the outer solar system, numbers like that are really useless. In fact, they're worse than useless because you think you know something when you see the number there in the book, and in fact you do not. The albedo could literally be essentially black. It could be literally 5% or less. There are many objects known in the outer solar system. This is known from their spectra. The problem with the moons and Saturn is they're too faint and too close to Saturn to get good spectra. But in most cases, Titan is an exception to that, the biggest one. They're the brightest. There are a number of bodies in the outer asteroid belt. Most of the asteroids are this way. The rings of Uranus are probably made of this stuff. The two moons of Mars, in fact, are made of this stuff, which is blacker than any common rock that is known on Earth. Blacker than coal, blacker than slate, blacker than obsidian. It is the same material as a very interesting class of meteorites called carbonaceous chondrites are made of. And this carbonaceous chondritic material is not found on Earth for an excellent reason. When the Earth formed, and this is true also of Mercury, Venus, the Moon, and Mars, and probably at least the big moons of Jupiter as well, it may very well have been all the same stuff at first, but as soon as it formed, maybe even during its formation, the entire planet melted. And when it did that, it behaved as any mixture of liquids will do. All the different substances that made it up separated out by weight. The heaviest stuff fell to the center. That's the reason we have a big heavy iron core in the center of the Earth. Most of the Earth's iron is down there in that core, 1,800 miles below your feet. So, interestingly enough, is most of the Earth's gold. Then you have the heaviest rocks on the outside of the core, and the less heavy rocks, and still less heavy rocks, and so on, until you get to the very, very outside where you have the very lightest rocks. And that's what we're walking around on. That's what the crust of the Earth is made of. That process is called gravitational differentiation. And the name may sound frightening, but it's nothing more complicated than what happens when cream separates from milk, right? Exactly the same process. The light separates the top, heavy stuff falls to the bottom. We can calculate what the Earth would be made of if it had never differentiated. If you imagine taking a giant egg beater and stirring it all back together, you have undifferentiated material that the Earth started from, and exactly what carbonaceous chondritic meteorites are made of is what that stuff is. It is quite rich in carbon, hence the name carbonaceous, and that is why it is so black. And if you ever see a carbonaceous chondrite, you'll be impressed at how unbelievably black it is. Really, just a sooty appearing kind of material. In fact, carbonaceous chondrites are interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is that not all that carbon is there is just carbon. A good deal of it is present in quite complex organic substances, all the way up to amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Now, I don't mean by that they were made by living things in outer space. In fact, we can show from their chemistry that they were not. But what that does show is the same kinds of substances that living things are made of were present in the solar system at the very, very beginning, even before the planets had formed, because we think the meteorites are indeed remnants of those very earliest stages, the very first solid matter that ever formed out of a huge, originally hot cloud of gas and dust that became the solar system. So carbonaceous chondritic material is found in large amounts in the outer solar system, and there's going to be a time when that fact is very important. The stuff is really wonderful for making space colonies out of. It has all of your metallic substances that you might want, it has oxygen, and it has silicon so you can make glass, and it has all of these organic things in addition. And so you can synthesize what on Earth would be the equivalent of petrochemicals. And in fact, carbonaceous chondrites are as rich in organics as oil shales. So they're good things. You'll be hearing much more about them, I think, in the decades to come. At the moment, though, their existence is a darn nuisance, because it means that that moon there, for example, might be made of a substance that is literally blacker than coal. On the other hand, it could very well be made of, or at least covered by, ice, and therefore have a very high albedo, 70-80%, who knows? And it could be anything in between. And so all you can give is a huge range of possible sizes, depending on your assumed albedo, and the one that they give you in the astronomy books is just assuming it's the same albedo as the moon, which in fact is probably the one assumption you can make that isn't true. As I mentioned last time, things in the outer solar system are just not made of the same things in here for reasons that are very simple and straightforward and easy to understand. There are two moons of Saturn that we do know some things about. One of them is Titan, which is a very, very interesting body. It is the only moon in the solar system that has an extensive atmosphere. I mentioned last time that Io and probably all of the moons of Jupiter have very thin atmospheres, something in the order of 20,000 as dense as the Earth. But Titan has an atmosphere that is at least as dense as that of Mars, and maybe as dense as that of the Earth. And we do not know what it's made of. We look at the spectrum and we can see methane. And for a long time, in fact, starting in 1943, when those methane bands were discovered by the late Gerard Kuiper, who was one of the great planetary astronomers of this century, and indeed almost the only planetary astronomer for a good part of this century, planetary astronomy just went out of fashion between about 1910 and about 1960, for various historical reasons that had to do with the development of astronomy. And Kuiper made that discovery. He found the methane was there, a certain amount of it, and so for a long time he thought the sun had an atmosphere, that little bit of methane and nothing more. Methane, if you're not familiar with it, is the gas that you cook with, so you are familiar with it. It's also marsh gas. It's CH4, one carbon atom, four hydrogen atoms, and it's therefore a very simple organic substance. It is also an extremely common material in the universe. But then, a few years ago, it was discovered that there is an unknown second gas in the atmosphere of Titan, which does not have spectral lines that are conveniently observable, and unfortunately there's some gas at which that's true, but which is there in great enough amounts that its pressure is affecting the spectrum of the methane. I realize those of you who don't know what spectrum is, this is all we to, but I'm just, you know, for those of you who do, I'm just passing it on to tell you how we know. There is an effect on spectral lines called pressure broadening, and the more pressure you got, the more the effect is. So you can estimate roughly the total atmospheric pressure, even the component that is due to the gases that you can't detect directly. And it turns out most of the atmosphere of Titan is indeed some gas that we cannot detect directly. Well, there are a number of possibilities for what that gas might be, but when you look at the chemistry of what things in the outer solar system are made of, Titan's solid body is probably made of a mixture of frozen water, frozen methane, and frozen ammonia, for reasons that I described last time. And given that chemistry, the most likely constituent, the most likely candidate for the nature of that second gas is hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is a gas that has a phenomenally strong greenhouse effect. Greenhouse effect means that if a world has an atmosphere, it is hotter than it would be if it were the same distance from the sun, getting the same amount of radiation with no air. You can see that very clearly if you compare the Earth and the Moon. They're both essentially the same distance from the sun, and so you'd expect they'd be the same temperature. But they're not. Ignore the fact that there are big temperature variations on the Moon. Just take the average. The average temperature on the Moon is almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit colder than the average temperature on Earth. And the reason for that is due to just a little bit of atmosphere, really, compared to some other body that the Earth has. Venus has a phenomenally high greenhouse effect. It has an atmosphere that's made almost entirely of carbon dioxide, which has a very high greenhouse anyway, and it is 100 times as dense as the Earth. So on Venus, the temperature is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, day and night, summer and winter, pole and equator, even though Venus is farther from the sun than Mercury, it is actually twice as hot as Mercury. And the reason is entirely good old greenhouse effect. But what I'm leading up to is, Titan may have an atmosphere that is mostly hydrogen. If it does, and the density of that atmosphere is as great as some people think that it may be. It's hard to measure the pressure very well. Pressure button is a little tiny effect. But if it's at the extreme upper limit of what seems to be the possible ranges from the data that we have, Titan could have an atmosphere as dense as that of the Earth, made almost entirely of hydrogen, and that would give it enough greenhouse effect that even a billion miles from the sun, Titan could be as warm as the Earth is, and it could very well be the most likely candidate as an abode of extraterrestrial life in the entire solar system, not excluding Mars. It is also possible, for rather similar reasons, as I mentioned last time, that Jupiter and Saturn could have life swimming around their atmospheres. For that reason, that is, they have all this hydrogen in the greenhouse, for another reason too, both of them emit heat from inside themselves. What is more likely is not that Titan has life on it, or is hot enough to, but that it is still warm enough that pre-biological organic evolution has gone on this body. And by that, what I mean is, the difference from a chemist's point of view between you and a rock, or any other lump of inanimate matter, is that you are made of very much more complex chemicals, which undergo very much more complex reactions. It's all a matter of complexity, and complexity in chemistry is pretty much a matter of the size of molecules. You have millions of molecules, of atoms, in many of the molecules in your body. In fact, there's somewhere many more than millions. Whereas typical inorganic molecules are, you know, a few atoms. Salt, two atoms. Water, three atoms. That kind of thing. Well, somehow, life must have formed on the Earth by some process in which the simple substances, things like hydrogen, which in molecular form is two atoms, water, 3S, methane, 5S, and so forth, ammonia, got together and built up more and more and more complex substances. And of course, there were a lot of, there doesn't have to be any necessary purpose to this. There undoubtedly were a lot of side chains. We don't care about those. What we care about is the one set of reactions that happened to end up with more and more complex molecules, which eventually became so complex, in fact, they were a lot. That's called organic evolution. That's called chemical evolution, pre-biological evolution. It must have happened on the Earth. We do not know how it happened on the Earth, for a very simple reason. When the first living things did come into existence, they didn't know anything about how maybe 4 billion years later we would be interested in how it had happened. They just didn't have any knowledge of the importance of biochemistry. They were not conservationists at heart. What they were hungry at heart. And so they immediately turned around and gobbled up for breakfast whatever may have been left of their pre-living or organic but not living predecessors. And so the very fact that life originated on the Earth means we do not know how it happened. Well, I think you can see what I'm getting at. We would just love to find a world somewhere where this process got started, but was not able to go all the way, and yet was able to go far enough that it got to a fairly advanced stage, and so we can look at that stage and see how it happened. It is possible that Mars is such a world. If the findings of the Viking Biology Investigation, which was the search for life on Mars, did not uncover Martian life, and it is not at all clear yet whether or not we found life on Mars. The only thing that is clear is we found something there that was totally unexpected. It's either life that is very unlike anything that is on Earth, or it is chemistry that is very unlike anything that is on Earth, and that mimics life in a number of important respects. So it may be that Mars is such a world. But if not, or even if so, Titan is an excellent candidate for such a body. The problem is we know almost zero about Titan. We know its size, sort of. We know it's one of the moons in the outer solar system that are bigger than the planet Mercury. You know, people are forever asking, are there planets beyond Pluto? You can never prove that something doesn't exist, but the searches for them have been so extensive by now that I think the chances are exceedingly unlikely. Incidentally, if I ever make a statement that is proved wrong, I would like to be that one, you know. So if tomorrow somebody discovers one, I'll be very happy to look like an idiot. But I guess that, in fact, there are no planets beyond Pluto. But if you want other planets, I can give them to you. We got a whole bunch of planets, really exotic ones. Worlds that are so strange that they make Venus and Mercury and the Moon and the Earth and Mars look like twin brothers. And they're right here in our own solar system, and yet almost nobody's ever heard of them. And their names are Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, Titan, and Triton. They are the big moons of the outer planet, and they are fully planetary in size themselves. They just revolve around these enormous Jovian planets, and they look tiny compared to those. Titan is a full-scale world itself. It's as big as the planet Mercury, and it is really unfair to it to say there are only 9 planets, and then who cares about moons, which almost everybody does. You know, so they keep the little teeny, the worlds in the solar system, and they go to Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and, you know, they never tell them anything else. In fact, there are a whole bunch of others. Well, Titan is one, and maybe a very, very interesting body. But we don't know, for example, whether we are seeing a solid surface there or whether it's totally covered by clouds the way Jupiter and Saturn are. We do not know what it is made of, really, that frozen methane, frozen ammonia, frozen water thing is a guess. It's a good guess based on what we know about cosmic chemistry, but it's not based on direct measurement. We don't really know what its atmosphere is made of. Even if we do know what its surface is made of, we have no idea what that surface is going to look like. The geology, the landscape that could form on a world that is as different from the ones that we've seen now, all which are after all made of the same stuff. Why? As Titan is, just an incredible sort of thing that we're going to see. But we need to know a great deal about Titan. People get excited when they hear these things about Titan, and that's great, and I think they should. But I want to warn you about something. We know far less about Titan at this moment than Percival Lowell knew about Mars. He was the guy that thought that he could use canals on Mars and build up a whole beautiful model of how there was a civilization there that had dug the canals, and the polar caps were made of frozen water, and they melted every spring, and the water flowed down through the canals, and irrigated the dark areas he thought were green, and they're not even green, you know. And it turns out that all of this beautiful house and park is based on only about 2 very plausible assumptions, given the knowledge of the time. It's fashionable to say it's a lab at Lowell, because now we know he was wrong. Given the knowledge of his time, he was he was a perfectly excellent scientist, and just because he was wrong, you know, I mean, you can't expect a person to be omniscient. All you can expect him to do is decent reason given what is known at the time. Well, he was nevertheless disastrously wrong, because his few assumptions were wrong, and we know less about science now than he did about Mars. That situation, however, is going to change. We get some information about Todd, not terribly good pictures from Pioneer 11, but when the Voyagers get there, Voyager 1, Saturn encounter, has as its top priority, aside from Saturn itself and the rings, Titan. It is going to fly so close to Titan, well, it's going to fly 3,300 miles away, that we are going to get pictures of most of the surface of Titan with details so good that you will be able to see objects 20 feet across on the surface of the moon. This is just one example of something that we are going to be seeing over and over again in the next few years because of the Voyagers. Entire worlds, which at the moment are simply dots of light, totally unknown, suddenly becoming known in the space of a few hours. And so it's an incredible period, and I hope that the news media shares some of this excitement with you. If not, of course, I would have you come back and give you many lectures and tell you myself. But
heaven knows how many it would take, too.
And good to see you. Well, folks, welcome to part 87 of our lecture on the North Hemisphere of the Atlas. It's going to be a tremendous amount of material from the Voyagers. The entire surfaces of at least 15 separate worlds in at least as good detail as the best Earth-based telescopic pictures of our own moon. Most of those from just these two missions. And that's not even counting the Uranus option. That's Jupiter, Saturn, and moons of Jupiter and Saturn. We will get all of the moons of Saturn, all the ones we're sure of, except for the very innermost Minos and the very outermost Phoebe, with that kind of resolution. And we will get five of the moons of Jupiter the same way. And these are all unknown bodies at this moment. Titan was going to be the most spectacular. That is the closest flyby of the entire Voyager program, and those, therefore, are going to be the most incredibly fine resolution pictures. So, we shall know very much more about Titan in a few moments. Now, let's see what the next slide is. I think it's the one that I... Yes, there we go. This is one of the most famous astronomical paintings ever made, and I think you can see why. This is a view of Saturn, which we can never get from Earth, because it is a crescent. The Sun is on the other side of it. And of course, we are closer to Saturn than the Sun is, and so we always see it at full phase or very near it. A crescent Saturn with those rings must be one of the most magnificent things to see from a sheer aesthetic point of view in the solar system. Now, the Voyagers are not going to land. This is a painting that was done in 1944 by the great astronomical artist Jesse von Estelle, who is still at the age of 90-something, thank God, very much with us, very much alive, and doing very magnificent paintings. And, you know, may he continue indefinitely. This is probably his most famous painting, and I think deserves it so. Of course, in 1944, he didn't know what we know now about Titan. And so, this is supposed to be a picture of Saturn, and it seems from the North Pole, from near the North Pole of Titan. The material of the surface of Titan should not be rock, we know that now. He has it covered with snow, but there probably is no rock at all. There may be, though. There's very much that we don't know, and it's possible that the rock has made its way to the surface. There's some reason to believe that something of that sort has happened, or at least some of the big moons of Jupiter. Also, von Estelle has painted a blue sky, a fairly dark blue sky, but a blue one. He assumed very much less atmosphere than, in fact, we now know that Titan has. Remember the date. This was painted just 1 year after that discovery in Kuiper of the methane portion of the atmosphere of Titan, which at the time we thought was everything that there was. And so, of course, it was very much in von Estelle's mind. But although it is now known not to be an accurate painting, I want to show it to you anyway because it is such a beautiful painting and because it gives you an idea of the kind of magnificence that exists for us to see in the outer solar system, and that we will be seeing in the Voyager pictures. They're not going to land, so we won't have a landscape like this in the foreground, but we will get pictures of the crescent Saturn with the rings there looking like some impossibly beautiful bow and arrow. We will get that from the Voyagers, both of them, as they fly around on the other side of Saturn on the way up, right around the solar system.
there must be enormous numbers of magnificent spectacles in the outer solar system. For example, imagine, this is beautiful enough, but imagine that you're on Minos, the innermost of the moons, and the innermost that we're sure of anyway, and if you look up and saw Saturn covering one third of the sky. Another Donatello painting, again from 1944. And as if this were not enough, imagine what it would be like to be down in the atmosphere of Saturn itself. You cannot land, there's no solid surface. But in the atmosphere, high up in the air, in a balloon, for example, and we may very well be sending balloons into the atmospheres of the outer planets to study them. It's an obvious way to keep a probe in the outer atmosphere rather than having to go into the dense inner part and the hot inner part to get destroyed. And in fact, you may see a preview of that in the very dense and hot atmosphere of Venus in the early 1980s. The French and the Russians are working on a balloon-borne spacecraft to be sent into the atmosphere of Venus and to study it from hundreds, several tens of miles above the surface where the heat is not so terribly great. What do you put in a balloon in an atmosphere that is made of hydrogen? Hydrogen. Right. Imagine that you are in the atmosphere of Saturn and you are looking up at a sky which is duplicated nowhere else in the solar system because from horizon to horizon is the arch of the Venus. Now this we cannot show you in a single picture, obviously. You would need, in fact this is something that a planetarium could do, you would need the whole 360 degree vision to be able to see this. And so when Bonestell decided to paint that, what he did was the best that he could do, given the fact that the painting was only going to take a small portion of the entire spectacle. And that is, he gave you a detail of it. What you would see if you were looking due south at midnight from the upper atmosphere of the planet, from a latitude about the same as we are here in Atlanta. And this is what you would see. Now you've got to remember, this is just a small part of this magnificent arch which goes from a vanishing point on one horizon across the sky to a vanishing point on the other horizon, like this, 180 degrees. This is the bottom edge of the ring. There you see Cassini's division. The rings are foreshortened. You're looking into the southern sky to see them, and so you're looking sort of at an angle across them. And this is something which from Earth we can see only bit by piece as the moon moves through it. On Saturn, you'll be able to see it every night. The entire thing, the shadow of the planet on the rings. Now the position of that shadow varies because Saturn's axis, and therefore the position of the equator, and therefore the position of the rings, is tilted with respect to the sun. And just as in the case of the Earth, as the planet moves around the sun, you get different angles of lighting at different times. So there are times when the shadow is going right across the rings and it's infinitely long in space, practically. There are times when it clears the rings altogether. This is the time when it just comes short of the outer edge of ring A. And the reason for this red border, which you would see, and which you can also see in an eclipse of the moon, is that some of the light of the sun goes through the atmosphere of Saturn. Two things happen to it. Number one, the shortwave rings get scattered out and produce the blue sky, which in fact you're seeing here even at midnight. Because those rings are so bright, they're lighting up the sky about the way a full moon does, as seen from Earth. And number two, the light gets bent. So only the longest wavelength light, which is the red color, gets through, and it gets bent around into what otherwise would be the shadow. And so you have this beautiful red tiny border of the rings. These pictures, I think, are previews of the sorts of things that we are going to be getting from the Voyagers in the next several years. They are artist conceptions, they are from a landing point of view or from a point of view high in the atmosphere, whereas Voyagers will see it through space, but I think they give you some hints of what to expect. Okay, let us go on to another object. This is not the object I had in mind, this is a discoverer. His name is Charles Cole, And the object that I'm talking about is Chiron, the so-called 10th planet, which, as I said, is not a planet at all. Charles Cole is a staff member at the world's largest telescope, until very recently, 200-inch at Mount Palomar, although, in fact, he spends most of his time not on the 200-inch, but on the 48-inch wide-angle camera, which can see almost as many objects as 200-inch, and takes in a very wide field of view, the 48-inch Schmidt camera, which is, again, one of the largest of its size in the world. Cole is photographed here sitting at a device called a blink microscope, which is what he used to discover Chiron and a number of other things as well. He's quite a guy. He discovered the 13th moon of Jupiter, Oleta. He discovered the 14th, probably. It is not certain that he hasn't got enough data yet to confirm it, but the chances are that it's there. He has discovered 80 supernovae, that is, floating stars in other galaxies. He has discovered a bunch of comets, and he has just a whole bunch of things. What he does is make systematic, routine, patient, methodical searches of the sky for various types of objects. And he is very, very successful at it, much more so than other people, to have tried the same thing. To some extent, this is an art as much as a science. What I find really inspirational about this story is that Charles Cole has only a bachelor's degree. And so, for those of us who, like myself, do not have a PhD, and get a certain amount of flack as a result of it in the astronomical community, especially when trying to find jobs, I think it's very nice that there's somebody who's gone so far with so little. So, for those of you who don't have your bachelor's yet, I realize how that sounds, but cheer up, the worst is yet to come, believe me. I don't mean that literally. In many ways, it gets better. In some ways, it gets worse. The work gets harder, but at least you're doing what you wanted to do, sort of, in a way. You keep telling yourself that over and over as you're working on your thesis. Well, Charles Cole, the blink microscope, is a device that allows you to compare two pictures of the same part of the sky, taken with the same instrument, and rapidly look at one and look at the other, look at one and look at the other. And if you see a particular star, and here's in the one picture, and here's in the other picture, you blink back and forth and nothing changes. You know, it looks the same. If anything changes, for example, a star is very bright, as I said, discovered supernova, or the object has changed position, as I said, discover an asteroid or something like Chiron, then you see it flash on and off, or jump back and forth, or whatever it is going to do, as you compare rapidly the one picture to the other. And so that's the device that he used to discover Chiron. Here is the discovery photograph, or rather a highly enlarged portion, very tiny portion of the discovery photograph, on which there is one little bitty trail. This thing down here is a photographic defect, and I believe these are also. That, however, is a star, and so is that, and so is that. And what happened was, Chiron moved very, very slightly during the several hours that it took to take the exposure. Now, that's not unusual. Here you can see an asteroid which happened to do exactly the same thing. It just happened to be in the same direction. But you notice the trail of Chiron is very much shorter. That implies that Chiron was not moving nearly as fast, right? And that in turn implies that it was very much farther out in the solar system than this more typical asteroid. So, when Cole discovered this, he got enough observations of it to work out a preliminary orbit so that at least it wouldn't get lost. And it's easy to lose something like this, you know, it's very, very faint. It's 50 times fainter than Pluto. It's a good deal closer in than Pluto, but it's also very, very much smaller. And then other people were able to observe it and get a still better orbit. And finally, an orbit was calculated was good enough that you could figure out where it would have been back in the 1940s, for example. And astronomers always save old photographs, even for decades, even for more than a century, because there are so many things in the sky, and there are so many things that we know we have yet to learn, that if you throw away your photographs, you're throwing away a lot of information that would be valuable for future generations. So every observatory maintains a huge plate file with old pictures. And astronomers then got out some of these old pictures that happen to show the area where Chiron should have been back 30 years or so before it was discovered, and found it. It wasn't too terribly far off from where it would have been predicted to be in the tentative orbit. From that, they were able to get a very, very good orbit, and so we now know a great deal about the nature of Chiron, at least as far as its orbit is concerned. It is not a planet. The reason I say that is that by definition, a planet is something which revolves around the sun, which Chiron does, but which is tiny. The biggest planet, the smallest planet that we've got, with a possible second Pluto size we simply do not know, is Mercury, and Mercury is 3,000 miles across. We do not know the size of Chiron, obviously. I mean, look at how little we know about it, just this little trail of light. And then another picture in which you track fire with a telescope and then a dot of light, but still only a dot of light. So all you know about it is it's brightness. And in fact, the two things get a spectrum, unfortunately, so you can't figure out what it's made of, therefore get a hint as to its albedo. From the brightness, you can get a big range of possible sizes, depending on the albedo. If you assume that it is made of really black stuff, carbonaceous chondritic material, then to be this brightness, it is 400 miles across. And if you assume that it's made of really white stuff, if it's either made of or covered with some sort of ice or snow, then it is only 100 miles across. In any case, there is no way that it can be bigger than 400 miles across, and an object that is that tiny simply is not referred to as a planet. If you want to redefine the term so that you start referring to it as a planet, then you have got to call several of the asteroids in the belt between Mars and Jupiter planets as well, because there are a number of them that are in that size range. Ceres, the biggest asteroid, is 500 miles across, and so it's definitely bigger than Chiron, and several of the others may be bigger than Chiron, depending on how big Chiron is. So even if you wanted to redefine the term, Chiron would not be the 10th planet, it would be somewhere around the 11th or 12th or 14th or something like that. But, in fact, we won't redefine the term. Asteroid is the term that is used for a small body with a small body, say, which revolves around the sun. As compared to something that revolves around a planet, whether it's big or small, is referred to as a satellite or a moon. And the point is that asteroids are mostly found in the belt between Mars and Jupiter. There are 2,000 or so of them known, and there are undoubtedly tens of thousands of others that are smaller that we haven't discovered yet, and indeed every year several dozen are discovered, either by astronomers who couldn't care less and doing something else, and just happen to get a trail like this one in one of their plates, and in many cases they simply ignore it, because nobody terribly cares very much about one more asteroid anymore, any more than, say, an entomologist gets excited by discovering one new anthill. But, you know, we still do track down several of them, several dozen every year. Most of them are in the belt between Mars and Jupiter. There are some which stray outside that belt, although most of them have at least parts of their orbits in that belt. None of those, however, is really large. Chiron, therefore, is by definition an asteroid. Now, I'll say something more about that in a moment. I claim by definition it's an asteroid. However, it is the only known case of a large asteroid whose orbit is not in the asteroid belt. Here is what its orbit looks like. Most of it is in between the orbits of Uranus and Saturn, and that indeed is where it was discovered. It was discovered right there. Interestingly enough, it was discovered just about the hardest possible place, almost at as far as possible distance from the sun. It would have been much easier in there. The last time that it was in there was in the 1940s, and probably the reason it wasn't discovered then was simply World War II. There just wasn't very much astronomy being done. But, in fact, even now, it's an exceedingly difficult thing to discover because it is so faint. Charles Kowal is probably the only person on Earth who could have made this discovery, at least at this moment in astronomical history. There are only about 5 telescopes in the world which have the combination of wide field of view necessary to find something that is unknown. I mean, you photograph a whole sky with a 200-inch telescope and you're going to be doing it literally the rest of your life, and in fact, far beyond that. So, combination of very wide field and capability of photographing very thin dots. There are only about 5 telescopes on Earth that have that capability. They're all the design called Schmidt telescope. And of those 5, only one is at present actually being used for a search for new objects in our solar system. And that one is the 48-inch Schmidt telescope on Mount Palomar. And the guy who's doing it, the only guy who's doing it, is Charles Kowal. So that's kind of interesting. It must give him quite a feeling of pride to realize that he's the only person on Earth who could have found this thing. At its closest, Chiron's orbit does cross the orbit of Saturn and come inside, come closer to Saturn to the sun than Saturn does. However, it crosses it only on this two-dimensional diagram. You've got to realize that space is three-dimensional. It crosses it in the way a bridge crosses a road, so there's no possibility of a collision. However, this is a very interesting kind of orbit, because it is reminiscent of the orbit of Pluto. Pluto is the only planet whose orbit crosses, again in the same sense, three-dimensional, crosses the orbit of another planet, namely Neptune. As a matter of fact, it is about to do so. Starting next year, 1979, Pluto, for 45 years, will be closer to the sun than Neptune. which means that for the entire rest of my professional life, I am going to have to put up with little kids who correct me every time they describe Pluto as the outermost planet, a prospect I'm not looking forward to. However, Pluto's orbit is that way for reasons that we don't know. And there are a lot of things about the origin of Pluto that just seem to be strange. There are a lot of respects in which Pluto is different from all the other planets. For one thing, it's the only planet in the outer solar system that is small. All it does is giant Jovian, a gas giant. Pluto is a little bitty thing, so small we don't know how small it is, but again, you get a rough notion, and it's definitely less than 4,000 miles across. It may be as little as 1,000 miles across. There is some reason to believe that Pluto may be an escape moon of Neptune, that this may be a moon that moved so far away from the planet that it actually escaped entirely. Actually, it's more simple. It's more complicated than that. You wouldn't need an interaction with the other moons in Neptune's system. And Neptune has two moons that we know of, both of which have really weird orbits. It looks as though there is some sort of disturbance of all of the moons, of both of the moons anyway, in Neptune's family. And it's entirely possible that what may have happened is that Pluto got thrown out and Trigon and Nereid, the other two, got put into these strange orbits that we see that they have. But there are other possibilities. The question is, what is Tyrus? Now, Charles Cole has a letter in the Letters to the Editor column of the current issue of the Sky and Telescope. And in that, he says it is not an asteroid. This is a matter of semantics. I think that what's happening is he made this discovery and he's justifiably proud of it and he wants it to be as good as possible. And so what he's saying is it is a brand new type of object. It's something we've never seen before. What he says is it probably has an origin and a composition that is different from those of the asteroids in the asteroid belt. The problem is that's totally irrelevant. The definition of the word asteroid has nothing to do with origin or composition. It has to do with size and with the fact that it orbits around the sun. And so if you want to say, I mean, I've already said it's unusual where that asteroid goes. It's the only big one that is outside the belt. In fact, it is almost the only asteroid we know that has an orbit that takes it this far from the sun. There's only one other I can think of, Hidalgo, that goes this far out, and Hidalgo has an orbit that looks like this. And so for average distance from the sun, Chiron is absolutely unique. There is no other asteroid that is anything like that far out from the sun. It is possible that Chiron may be just the beginning of a whole new asteroid belt between Saturn and Uranus. In fact, I asked him about that. And he said it is quite possible. I have only searched about one-third of the, and then use the technical term, which basically means band of sky where you expect to find these things. And Chiron is the only one that I found of that brightness, and it's entirely possible that there are things out there that are thinner as well. And of course, you know, one day you're going to go back and take longer exposure photographs, which takes that much longer, and see what we've got here. It's also possible, as George Wallerstein suggested, that Chiron and Pluto may just be the first two examples that we happen to have discovered of a whole family of objects that are out there, orbiting around the sun, coexisting with the planet, moving in among the planet. And if you want to call that an asteroid belt, also fine, but perhaps it's wider than the distance between the Earth and Saturn here. And it is possible that they are related to the comets. Now, the comets are bodies that I'm not going to be able to say very much about today, simply because there isn't going to be time. I mean, I'm trying to cover 35 or more separate worlds as it is in one lecture, and try to get into 100 billion comets as well, and it would get a little bit ridiculous. But suffice it to say that a comet is a whole lot of gas and dust which comes off every once in a while, and when the comet comes close into the sun, a body which for most of the time, for virtually all of the comet's lifetime, is all that there is. There isn't a big cloud of gas and dust that we see. The little body is called the nucleus of the comet. It is made, we think, it's all theoretical. We've never seen a comet because it's too small. But this theory is generally accepted by cometary astronomers for a whole bunch of reasons which I don't know, but we have to come back to kind of give a lecture about it if you like. I mean, I got a whole comet lecture, and it takes that long to do the justice. But we, you know, if you'll take my word for it, this is what a comet is, and we think it probably is. Most of the time, all it is a little nucleus. The nucleus is a few miles across. It is made of frozen water, frozen methane, and frozen ammonia, the same three substances again, so common all through the universe, mixed with dust, maybe frozen carbon dioxide in there as well, so arguing over that. Some of them may or may not have a rock core inside, and in other words, some of them snowballs, and some of them snowballs are rock inside, or some maybe snowballs are rocket inside, we don't know. We know very little about comets. One of these days we've got to have a space mission to go and fly past a nucleus and then someday go and land on a nucleus and bring back samples of material. But suffice to say that the comets are these snowball kinds of things, and the nuclei, as far as we know, are pretty small. It is possible that Chiron, Pluto, and some of the moons of the outer planets may be related. They may be the same kind of objects, only bigger. Maybe the whole size spectrum of these things. You see, we're getting into a lot of maybe. What has happened here, to get back from the maybe to a definite, is that whatever Chiron is, it is very, very important simply because it exists. It is showing us that there is a brand new component to the outer solar system. There is at least one, and maybe a whole class, of objects, other types whose existence we have no reason to suspect. So whether you want to call it an asteroid or not, doesn't much matter, and it may be that the terminology is just going to remain in limbo for some time until we find out whether in fact there are more of them and what they're like. It is possible that some of the moons of the outer planets may have been such objects which were originally orbiting around the sun and were captured by those planets' gravity. In the same way as we think that Jupiter and Mars on the outer side of the asteroid belt that we know captured at least some of their moons from the asteroid belt that we know. Both the moons of Mars are almost certainly captured asteroids. We get from some recent Viking data, that again is not a whole lecture. I mean, there's so much movement. And the other moons of Jupiter, for reasons that I told you about last time, are probably captured asteroids as well. So, you know, one out there too. Some of the orbits of, especially the outer moons of some of the outer planets, look very much as though they did originate by capture. For example, Phoebe, the outermost moon of Saturn, has an orbit which is in the opposite direction, moves in the opposite direction, moon of the outer solar system. One of the main differences between the outer solar system and the inner solar system is that out there, there are an awful lot of moons, and in here, there are not. And that's one of the many things about the structure of the solar system we do not understand. So maybe, in fact, the outer planets have even more moons than we know about, and some of them go inward and get broken up when they pass inside the planet's rotation limit. Who knows? That may even happen time after time, all through the history of the solar system. And each shadow planet only lasts a few hundred million years, and so we only see the one that happens to be around at the moment we walk. And perhaps there's another moon that has been moving upward and escaping. We don't know. The important thing is we are seeing that there are things, there's a whole, perhaps, class of bodies in the outer solar system that we know existed, or, if there's not a class, there is one single unusual object in the outer solar system that we didn't know existed. And either way, this is telling us here is another feature, unexpected feature in the solar system that you are going to have to explain. Let's move on now to Uranus. You may think, gee, it's going to be a really interminable lecture. Well, of course, you know my knowledge are. However, it's only fair to point out the blocks are about to get very much shorter. And the reason is, you have all these things to say about the planet so far, but we know less and less the farther out we go. You will be amazed at how fast I get through Neptune, let alone Pluto. So cheer up. In fact, the main part of the lecture is almost over, and that's why there hasn't been an intermission yet. All we'll do is have an intermission, and then for those of you who are interested, I will talk about the Voyager mission per se, which I think is interesting, but, you know, probably the least important part of the lecture, so it's the one. I mean, it's all terribly important compared to almost anything else that happened, but, you know, compared to the rest, it's the least important. So that's the reason we'll put after the intermission for those that can't stay for the whole thing. I know this close to finals, it's really an act of great loyalty for you all to be here this long, and I really do appreciate it. Well, Uranus is so little known that most people don't even pronounce its name correctly. They say Uranus, and it is not. It's Uranus. It has nothing to do with it's Uranus. This is probably the best photograph of it that has ever been taken. I'm sure you've all read the caption by this time. It was photographed in a way that got you above the turbulence due to the Earth's atmosphere. And what I think you can see is it's absolutely featureless. We don't even know whether we are seeing clouds or a clear atmosphere when we look at that planet. We found out last year that Uranus has a day, a rotation period, three times as long as the number that's been in the astronomy textbook since the 1930s. And that number turned out to be done, it turned out to be arrived by a good, very primitive method by modern standards, by a couple of astronomers who had essentially nothing else to do. There was very little interest in the planets in those days, and all the interest in the planets that there was very, very little interest in Neptune. Nobody paid any attention to it. Even people that did study planets, studied Jupiter and Saturn, when they wanted to go beyond planets, they just said, well, you know, Uranus and Neptune are more the same. And that's ridiculous. We know now, especially how ridiculous it is, how very, very different every planet that we have looked at has turned out to be. In fact, all the textbooks that study Uranus and Neptune are twins. They're the same size and both green. That's where they get the twin thing from. That's what we know about them. They're the same size, roughly, they're both green. And the reason they're green is they have a lot of methane in their atmosphere and that absorbs light in such a way to make them green. So fine, you know. But if we were at the distance of Uranus or Neptune, you know, you're 2 billion miles from the sun here. And Neptune, you're going to be 3 billion miles from the sun. If we were at that distance and we looked at the Earth and Venus, we would think they were twins. All we could tell would be they're the same size and they're both totally covered by clouds as far as we can tell from that distance. You know? And then one looks bluish and the other looks a little whitish. But other than that, Venus is sort of yellowish white. But they're both totally covered by clouds. You know, as far as we can tell, that is. I would be very, very surprised if it doesn't turn out that Uranus and Neptune have all kinds of differences one from another when we finally find out. And I think it's even Phobos and Deimos, the two little baby moons of Mars, and when a body gets that small, it has much less